Look at the adjective. Play.
I respect you, Booker man.
And I have half the brain that you do.
Right.
A shot.
I told you.
Now is the franchise going to take the Viagra?
Gonna put some butts in the seat.
Hello there, wrestling fans, and welcome to episode 2 of Because WCW. Thank you very much for downloading this podcast. Thanks for joining us. If you're with us for episode 1, great to see you back again, or hear you back again, I suppose. And if you're your first time listener, then welcome. And this is the second of what we hope will be many, many podcasts. My name is the Twisted Genius, Dean Ayers, and I am joined as ever by my good friend and esteemed sports journalist, Liam Happ. Liam, how are you doing?
Inverted commas on the esteemed, but I'm very good. Thank you for asking.
We have another classic lined up for you today. We are looking at WCW Bash at the Beach 1998. Before we get on to that, just want to acknowledge that since we recorded episode 1, we have lost not one, but two greats from WCW, Bobby the Brain Heenan, and going back slightly further in time, Lance Russell, who both passed away recently. Our thoughts with their families, and what great individuals they both were, what amazing legacies they've left in this business.
Yeah, definitely, and especially in my instance, and I know this is the case for a lot of people who will be listening, especially with Bobby Heenan, who, you know, for guys like us, he was there of that perfect age, our childhoods. Him and Gorilla Monsoon over on the WWF programming, he had a great few years in WCW, and I know he very openly discussed how sick of WCW as were a lot of people towards the end, and he kind of like faded out with a bit of a whimper professionally. But I'm so glad he got to, he had that moment, didn't he, at WrestleMania 17, probably the greatest ever WrestleMania, having a laugh with Mean Gene at the Gimmick Battle Royal. Unfortunately, he'll never get to see whether or not Iron Sheik makes it to the ring for WrestleMania 38, but what a career he had. What a man.
What an absolute legend. Both guys, both Heenan and Lance Russell, just the absolute best in the business at what they did. And, of course, Bobby Heenan, a commentator on the team for Bash at the Beach 98. So we kick things off with some sorts of, I've noted here, as epilepsy-inducing opening titles.
Yeah, well, I think we touched upon this when we covered Starrcade 97 on the first episode. The video packages that they'd put in to the pay-per-views, and sometimes even on Nitro and then later Thunder, they really rode a fine line between genius and disturbed.
Starrcade 97 was brilliant.
Yeah.
And this was just a bit weird.
Yeah.
And I think something else that we'll probably look at quite regularly on this is the exact phrasing of Tony Schiavone's opening hyperbole. And this time around, Mr. Schiavone tells us that never in the history of this grand sport has there been so much scrutiny, so much talk, so much media attention about one match and one night. And obviously he's talking about the tag team main event that involves Dennis Rodman and Karl Malone from NBA basketball.
Yeah, and what he's conveniently leaving out there amidst all the hyperbole is that it wasn't really one night, it was two. But I'm sure we'll get the chance to discuss Rodman getting absolutely hammered the night before a Pearl Jam concert at some point when we discuss the main event. I'm really looking forward to that one, because if there was ever, well, unfortunately there are several, but if there was ever a short list of matches that could single-handedly fill an episode, I think this very main event is one of them.
It's an interesting match, yes. So we will get onto that later on. So, yeah, we don't take Tony Schiavone's intros all that seriously, because I'm sure Hogan and Andre had a bit more scrutiny, talk and media attention, but hey. So it is Bash at the Beach, and they are, of course, dressed up appropriately, and Shivani is wearing what is an absolutely hideous Hawaiian shirt. And, I mean, I feel comfortable describing certain Hawaiian shirts as hideous, given my own Hawaiian shirt collection. His shirt's worse than Heenan, and I'm thinking Heenan's meant to be the heel here. But what I feel sorry for is that Mike Tenay is in sort of a black and white casual polo shirt. It's very subdued. And I've noted here that Mike Tenay, rather than looking at, like someone on the beach, he looks like a maths teacher on a road on a field trip.
Yeah, Tenay will deadpan it all the way to the bitter end. I love that about him. I love the whole thing in general. The, you know, it's not just Bash at the Beach, but Halloween Havoc. They'd really go into so much detail to gimmick up these pay-per-views with the dress code and silly things. I love the outfits, to be honest. I love the crazy shirts. I'm not quite sure if they're not, if they are worse than what you have worn in the past, because Dean, I seem to remember you wearing a Freddie Mercury pattern shirt to a wrestling event once.
Oh, no, that was a shirt with lots of different famous people's faces on. I think it was like Toulouse-Lautrec, Mahatma Gandhi, Bob Marley, and a few other people. I have still got that somewhere nestling in a cupboard. Yes,
oh, but no, that's all right then.
But it's good, as you say. It's good that they do theme up the dress code. You know, Halloween Havoc. They're wearing various costumes. It makes it interesting. Now, what is notable here is that before we start the pay per view, they notify us that this is the first pay per view with Goldberg as champion, because of course they gave Goldberg v Hogan away for free on Nitro at the Georgia Dome in Atlanta 6 days previously in front of 40,000 fans.
Yes, and that's always going to... that one, yeah, it is a because WCW moment in one way, but to be honest, that one's always going to polarise the fans, because it was a huge moment, and we've got to remember, TV was very important for both companies. Dave Meltzer is always the first one to say, you know, what gets lost in the shuffle of the importance of ratings during the Monday Night War was that ratings weren't important at all. Yeah, it was only important within the spirit of competition, but what mattered above all else remains the same. Buy rates, merchandise, making money, getting people to show up to events. So, in a sense, it doesn't really come to much, but you know, the way that everyone looks at the Monday Night Wars, and rightfully so, because it was, we've said it before, we'll say it again, it was the most incredible time frame in wrestling, and it will never be beaten, and it was very much in the spirit of that. But I'm sure I've got a funny feeling that if we ever move from pay-per-views to Nitros, that'll be one of the first ones we go in depth on. But yeah, okay. Goldberg at this point is the champion, and this is, I think the important thing is, this is the start of a sadly recurring theme, which is another nail in the coffin of WCW. This will be Goldberg champion, nowhere near the main event. Used to that.
Second from the top, I believe. And Hogan's in the main event.
Yep.
I mean, the story that I always read regarding that episode of Nitro was that Hogan knew that they'd sold the Georgia Dome out. They had 40,000 people there, and he wanted to be in the main event, despite, you know, they'd sold those tickets before anyone knew what the main event was. So he wanted to, you know, do something to put himself in the spotlight for that big show. But, you know, what's noticeable is that there was never a, I think that was the only time Hogan and Goldberg faced each other one-on-one, I believe, wasn't it? There's never a pay-per-view rematch or anything to make pay-per-view money out of it.
No, I'm actually quite thankful with hindsight that it was their only meeting, because some of the rumours were that Hogan agreed to drop the title to him in return for getting it back at a pay-per-view. And we do, you know what, we have no proof to say that definitely happened, but look at his track record. Warrior, he once famously tried to get WCW to sign Yokozuna, just because Yokozuna beat him and he wanted to get the pin back. So
yeah, I heard that one too. Yeah,
it wouldn't surprise me if he was angling for the rematch at a time where it would have made no sense whatsoever. Because as we touched upon on the Starrcade 97 podcast, that was the end of the run. That was the New World Order story. That was where it was going to start to get tedious at any point after that. And here we are, 6-7 months later in the time frame, and it's still raging on.
Yep. And before we get to the opening match, the last thing that we have before we go to the action is that Mean Gene becomes, as far as I'm aware, the first man to ever wear a tuxedo to a beach party. But he looks so smart. He's wearing a white jacket, and of course he has a quick shill of his hotline.
Of course.
No CD or sleazy. Teasers, but what I love is watching it back on the WWE Network. There's a disclaimer across the bottom that just says phone line no longer active, and it did make me think, would anyone still call the WCW hotline today?
Oh man, you would be surprised. And they do get a lot of use out of that crawler because they have to superimpose it on, you know, ECW TV has it, because they'll have like hotlines on the broadcast, yeah. Even some of their own stuff from like the 90s and 80s, they have to just retcon it and say, look, this is an old thing. But you'd be surprised how many people would actually turn around and go, oh, I'm going to ring that.
Let's never underestimate the intelligence of the great general public, eh?
Exactly.
So, match number one is Raven's Rules match of Saturn versus Raven. Saturn has, since our last pay-per-view, our last episode of this podcast, rather, he has left the flock. He's on his own. He's back to wrestling in boots and trunks. Raven comes out to the ring accompanied by Lodi and Scotty Riggs, although Scotty Riggs himself isn't identified until 5 minutes into the match, and even then the commentators aren't 100% sure if it's him or not.
Dude in Eye Patch.
Yeah.
Should be his new name.
And it starts now. I don't know what your thinking is on opening matches, but I've always kind of thought that an opener should be not a relatively gentle introduction into the show for people, and you know, let things build from there. But this one starts out as an intense brawl all around ringside, and that kind of made me wonder, you know, is this something to grab the attention of non-fans or lapsed fans who've bought the pay-per-view simply to see the main event?
Yeah, I think I'm kind of adjacent to your agreement. I kind of agree with you, but for different reasons. The thing that stood out to me about this is that, you know, I know we've, on the podcast, we've jumped, but those of us who followed WCW back in the day will be well aware of the Raven story arc since he arrived in WCW the year before. You know, it was a really good progression. It was one of the best things in their mid-card. And this match had a lot behind it, with Saturn leaving the flock and then trying to liberate the rest of the flock. It was a big grudge match. They got time on TV. They were over characters, as they say. And normally when you have that sort of guaranteed crowd investment, you put that later on the card because you know you're going to get a reaction from the crowd. For an opener, yeah. I agree about the gentle introduction, but you want to have something that's... Ideally, you go for something that's exciting in the ring, but not necessarily that much, that has that much investment from the fans. So if you
Which
just have a general...
Like you'd often get your cruiserweight matches and high-flying matches that just get a wow factor, but as you say, not a huge amount of investment from the fans.
Or maybe just a non-storyline match, whether it be like two technical guys who know how to pop them, or you get your good storytellers out who know how to play to the crowd and get them fined. Like a good heel against a random babyface is always a good opener. But you get two guys who take advantage of the hot crowd and just get it going a little bit. When you've got something that you know people care about, even if it's not the main event, you can put it wherever you like. So that surprised me about this.
Yeah. And then looking through the card, there isn't that much else that could have been the opener, apart from maybe the second match, but it's not.
I would say that would have been perfect, because if you remember at the time, if my memory serves me correctly, the second was Kidman Hoovy, right?
Yeah.
Now these two, I know they became cornerstones of the cruiserweight division, but circa the summer of 98, you know, Hoovy had lost his mask, needed a bit of rehab, and Kidman was only just starting to make a name for himself. And it's very much a random pairing of cruiserweights. That would have been perfect as an opener.
Yeah. So what I also noticed was that Raven's rules are no disqualification, but you can still reach the ropes to break submission.
Yeah, do you know what? You're going to hate me for this. I am fine with that. We're here now.
It's a little bit odd.
We've opened the can of worms. I might as well go here now. You know, a no disqualification match, you still have to win through legal means. Now, if he refuses to break a hold with a five count and then gets disqualified, that would make no sense because it's no disqualification. But the referee can say, look, that's not a correct way to end the match. And the match continues. But that's just, you know, I'm that guy, sorry.
I know I'm being massively pedantic as well. So,
I think we both are. We're here talking about because WCW, and we've already engaged in a massive... the nuances of the squared circle.
Yes. Tony Schiavone then calls a table a chair by mistake. And why is quite interesting that both Heenan and Mike today take the absolute mick out of him for it. And it seems to annoy Schiavone because he actually says to Heenan, are you going to do your whole routine here or what? And then he mentions it again later on in the show. So I don't know how if he didn't necessarily get on all that well with those guys or was just having a bad day or what. But he didn't seem to be particularly happy with them picking him up on that.
Yeah, Siobhan's situation with Heenan's quite well documented now. I think in a few shoot interviews before Heenan's passing, it was we'll get into that in more detail at some point, but there was definitely some behind-the-scenes issues between those two. I always got the impression, as far as the collective trio of them, I always got the impression that Schiavone liked to play those two off of each other, not necessarily in a sadistic or serious way, but he liked to have the goofiness played off by silly Heenan and a straight man Tenay so he can just be the main man. And there you go, something happens, and this is one of the rare times because Heenan's normally like making a bit of joke at Tenay's expense and Tenay will deadpan the shit out of it. Schiavone is actually united the two of them against him, and I don't think he liked that.
No, because there are several times in this pay-per-view where Mike Tenay gives some background information about the history of something, the history of Mexican wrestling, and he's clearly just reeled it all off from the top of his head, and he then basically just says, "How do you know all this stuff?" You know, there is, and as you say, it's taken the piss out of him a bit, but at the same time, I think it's done respectfully. But what we also have during this match, Nick Patrick is caught in the corner and takes what is an awesome-looking flying kick to the face from Saturn, and then he completely ruins it by ridiculously overselling it and remove any credibility from the spot, which in true WCW style they then show again in slow motion on the replay at the end of the match.
Yeah, he was horrible taking offense, wasn't he? Whenever that was required of him, and it was a few times because he's played heel as a referee more than once, so he has got his backside handed to him a few times, and he's always looked terrible doing it.
Yeah, and all you need to do for something like that is just collapse to the floor in a heap.
Yeah.
But he does anything but. And then Saturn leaps through two tables a good while after Raven had been saved. He sets two tables up, one on top of the other, puts Raven in between the two, to sandwich him between the two tables. And then Canyon appears out of nowhere, saves Raven, gets Raven in, throws Raven back in the ring, and then turns on Raven, hits a flatliner. And all of this, of course, is in the opening match.
Yep, and Russo doesn't arrive for another 15 months.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'm glad you touched upon that because this is the fit. Like I was as a kid, and even to this day, looking back at it, I was a huge fan of the, I loved Raven's story arc where he feuded with Benoit and DDP, culminating one of my favorite ever WCW matches, the Triple Jeopardy match for the US title. Then it moved on to Saturn coming out of the flock, and you had Canyon involved as well. The whole the storylines, and I think he mentioned in shoot interviews that he got a bit of creative license and he was allowed to run with it, and it was all great. The problem was a lot of the matches from the time were absolute messes. Like, they tried to do far too much, And as you point out, a lot of it just doesn't come off or exposes what they're trying to do here. And it's just such a mess of garbage from characters and wrestlers who we love and we know can do better. So that's a really gutting start. Well, it's a very because WCW start to the pay-per-view. But it's gutting because, you know, think of it at the time when everyone was lobbying for some of the hot youngsters at the time to be given pushes in WCW, so it wasn't just always Hogan and Savage and Nash in the main event. These were the guys. And then you look back at some of the matches and you think, well, they're not really doing themselves much of a case here, are they?
No, not at all.
Not where it matters.
So, yeah, we've had brawls, table spots, heel turns, all in the first match. Raven wins with his awesome DDT after Riggs interferes. We then get Eddie Guerrero coming out for an interview with Mean Gene to talk about the hair versus hair match against Chavo Guerrero Jr. And we've already got Chavo signed to a match with Stevie Ray before his match with Eddie, because he'd already signed the match with Stevie Ray before agreeing to the match with Eddie. So the gimmick here, I guess, is that Stevie Ray can wear Chavo down before Eddie takes his match. What's interesting as well is that Eddie stumbles over his words a few times on his promo. And when you consider when he was at his prime in the WWE, how good his promos and characterization were, and it was obviously not his forte at this point in his career. He hadn't really developed that side of things yet.
Maybe, but I think the biggest thing, because this was something that I was very much aware of going into the rewatch, the thing this stood out to for me was that it was there to kill time, which is so frustrating that you have to fluff out a completely needless interview with someone who's clearly not, as you said, he's not ready to go unless he's got a specific script and motive. You don't go to someone like Eddie Guerrero, right? Just go out there and talk for 5 minutes, you know. And they've sent him out to do just that, which is just, it's unforgivable, because there's a few matches on this card, as we'll go through them, you'll see what I mean, that really could and should have been given more time. And they find time for this. And one of the reasons why they were so disorganised, other than being fucking WCW, one of the reasons they were disorganised on the time management of this pay-per-view was because apparently Hulk Hogan had earmarked 45 minutes for his tag team main event featuring two basketball players.
45 minutes?
45 minutes, including entrances. And he was like, right, that's mine, brother. And as a result, they shortened out some of the other matches, and apparently they shortened them out too much. So it's like,
right,
get Mean Gene out there, get Eddie out there.
Well, I mean, the whole main event, sort of from including entrances and that, was around about half an hour in the end. So it wasn't the full 45 minutes, but it was still a long main event considering
this was two wrestlers
were in. But we'll cover that in a bit, I guess. So
yeah, I'll be happy to get to that, because there's an icing on the cake. But as you said, we'll work through this match to match, and I'll hold that one back. But it's an absolute gem.
Hoovington Guerrero, Lodi is out for this match again with Kidman, because Kidman's part of the flock. Shivani says, I guess this is Raven's rules for this match as well, which, again, just seems very odd to me, because as a commentator myself, one of the things I always make sure I find out about is the rules of the match or any stipulations, so I sound like I know what I'm talking about. I don't think it's announced as Raven's rules, it's just a bit of an odd thing to say, but the crowd just seem a bit dead for this one. I don't know if it's just because they've been burnt out by that all-action opener or what.
Yeah, they blew their load with an opener that actually wasn't that good in the grand scheme of things. Just a bunch of spots and pops. And as a result, a genuine choice in a more logical sense for an opener gets golf applause. It was a good match. I really enjoyed watching it. It weren't one of the best there. You know, I think those two guys in particular would do better matches that year alone, because they would be in the title picture towards the end of 98, and it may, you know, not to complain about Jericho's cruiserweight title reign, which was so entertaining and the start of a character that he just kept evolving for the next 20 years. But we were getting to a point at this stage in July at Bash of the Beach where Jericho, Malenko and the other little wrinkles weren't past their due yet, but they were starting to, they're in the dying embers of their run of being effective, and we were getting to a point where we really could have done with guys like Hoovy and Kidman being transitioned into the title picture. And it took a few more months, but I thought they did enough on this show to prove that they were ready to be the next guys involved in the belt. And that would come. That would come.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, what's notable is that the crowd only seemed to react and respond and pop for Kidman missing his shooting star press and Hoovy hitting the Hoovy driver and then the 450 splash for the win. And it's another, we mentioned this about Starrcade, looking at the crowd and looking at how the crowd are animated compared to the noise that I can hear on my screen. It just seems that they haven't done a very good job of miking the crowds again, which it also is noticeable for the main event, where you'd expect it to be a huge, deafening roar, and it isn't. I mean, you look at the obvious comparison to this show is WrestleMania 14 with Mike Tyson, and the size of the live audience is approximately the same. And yes, of course, Tyson's a bigger worldwide star than Rodman and Malone, but they're still pretty high up there. But the difference in the presentation and the atmosphere is poles apart.
I think to me, the key, I get what you're saying about live crowd, but I think the key difference to me was the fact that when all was said and done at WrestleMania 14, the big star was under WWF contract. But yeah, the crowd miking is baffling. And this one, from the top of my mind, from watching WCW, there'll be a lot of shows we cover that will have this same problem. We'll be coming back to this.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so we're now coming up to the next match, which is this is the Chavo Guerrero Jr. part of the show. What I just want to tell everyone who's listening here, basically, yeah, we will decide on what show we're going to cover, and then I don't know what you do, Liam, but I watch it blind as such. I don't read the results. I don't read anything about it. I just watch it as if I'm watching it live for the first time. And when I sent you a text saying, right, I'm watching Bash at the Beach tonight, you sent me a message along the lines of, oh, enjoy the Chavo Guerrero stuff.
Yes. That is definitely something I would say. At this point, I think Chavo Guerrero, he gets a lot of stick, especially in the last 10 years. He's not the sort of guy people want to see on their screen. Yeah, his time has come and gone. But there were two, in my opinion, there were two points in the timeline where he was incredible. And this is one of them. And he was a comedy character, but he was fantastic. He was hilarious. He was entertaining. And he went from being just another luchador in via family ties at WCW to being one of their guys. No, not a top tier guy, but one of their guys that fans know who he is from this feud, these antics. And then ironically, just as WCW was coming to an end and folding up, you're going to laugh when I say this, Dean, but he was probably one of the top 10 workers in the world. They made him cruiserweight champion again, and he was having some of the best matches you would find. And he helped make a sort of star, considering it's WCW and the cruiserweights, but he made a name out of Shane Helms, and he made a decent career himself. Even though he had to survive the takeover and the invasion, he did all right out of that.
Yeah, well, one of the WCW guys who had a long career afterwards.
Chavo at his peak was amazing, and for me, this was that first peak. There was very few people. You got your Norman Smileys and your La Parkas, and then you got like Chavo Guerrero, just will always put a smile on your face in this time frame. Case in point, our next match, Dean.
Yeah, so we start off with Stevie Ray and Chavo Guerrero.
Yes.
And obviously, as we touched upon there, the story at this moment in time is that Chavo Guerrero's gone barking mad, basically. And he comes out with a novelty horse rubber ring round his waist. Is this was before or after Pepe? I think this was before Pepe, wasn't it?
Pepe was the horse.
Pepe was the hobby horse, but yes. this is just the rubber ring with like a horse head
around. Oh, yeah, gotcha. Maybe it is Bash at the Beach, so I'm lacking it might take a bit more knowledge of the weekly Nitros, which I'm not quite so sharp on, but It was either a precursor of Pepe, or maybe it's just like the Bash at the Beach Pepe with a rubber ring.
Beach Pepe. Beach Pepe, definitely.
Beach Pepe. There you go. He's not going to drown.
He has Beach Pepe at his waist, and he's carrying a super soaker.
And he's soaking the fans.
Yes. who love it. Yeah. So he dedicates the match to Eddie, who's at ringside. And we have about a minute and a half of stalling. And then within seconds, Chavo shakes hands with Stevie Ray and submits. Which is obviously the easiest pay-per-view night Stevie Ray is ever going to have in his life. And Heenan summarises he saved himself for Eddie and maybe that he's not as mad as we all thought, which it's funny. It's a great little twist on things, but then it did leave me a bit confused. And so, well, especially how this second match with Eddie unfolds is like, well, what state of mind are we meant to think he's got? So I guess we'll come to that in a second. So this is a hair versus hair match, Eddie and Chavo.
Yeah.
And Mike Tenay explains the history of hair versus hair matches in Mexican wrestling while Heenan and Schiavone completely ignore him. But yeah, there is a huge, you know, a huge history of mask v hair and hair v hair and mask v mask matches in Mexico. The little touch that I love about this is that after the Chavo and Stevie Ray match went like a minute and 35, we've got a different referee assigned to this match, Charles Robinson. I just love that as a little touch. The match, I just found, unfortunately, I found this match a bit underwhelming, considering, you know, especially when you consider how well these two know each other and the fact there's a stipulation behind it. It just seemed a bit weak, and it had a weak finish, Eddie winning with a small package after they both started mucking around with scissors. It just fell a bit flat for me.
Yeah, it's funny in that they are one of the more famous pairings of opponents who never were able to have a truly great match with each other, despite all the history and the evidence suggesting that they tear the house down. I mean, they had that feud when they split up in the WWE just before Eddie was given the world title. And, you know, it was a good feud, but it was quite short and the matches weren't ever that great. They were good at best. Same with this, it was pretty good at best. Because of your confusion earlier, I did want to add a little context. You know, some of the people listening will remember this fondly, but for those who have no idea what's going on, basically they had a thing where Chavo, you know, he's a rookie, and he's, as I said before all this, he was a no name. He was just some guy. So he's, you know, clean nosed, all that. And Eddie, who's a heel at this point, and, you know, when he's a heel, he's one of the best in the business, or was one of the best in the business. And he's having Chavo, he's trying to take Chavo under his wing more by force than by kindness. I think they did a stipulation where Chavo lost and he was forced to be Eddie's like underling, and he would just abuse him and mistreat him and smack him around. And that's what led to him going loco. And there was a complete role reversal. Now Eddie was on the back foot from Chavo, but their feud had started. He'd kind of made his bed, and they've got a hair versus hair match coming up. And he's got to get in the ring with this absolute looney tune, the monster that he created. That's why the storyline was actually quite great. And it gets even better, because the whole thing was that, yeah, he'd already signed for this match. He was going to have Stevie Ray soften him up. And that's one of my favourite moments from WCW, where he just like taps out to a handshake so that he can take it to his uncle. The crazy thing is according to the Wrestling Observer, at one point they were seriously giving consideration, giving the minutes to Chavo versus Stevie Ray, and actually having Stevie soften him up, beat him up, probably pin him, and leave him in a wreck so that Eddie can come in and just pin him. And yeah, it's a bloody good thing that they changed tack on that, because could you imagine Stevie Ray versus Chavo getting 10 minutes? Even with a 1 minute match where they just did a handshake, I'm still surprised that Stevie Ray didn't blow a spot.
Well, I mean, the thing was that was so, that handshake submission was just so entertaining, you know. Yeah.
It was definitely the right thing. They avoided the because WCW, and they actually gave us one of the things we fondly remembered WCW for, which was great wrestlers and some great entertainment.
Yeah, but I mean, going back to, you know, we said about the chemistry between these two. I suppose, you know, you think about like Bret and Owen Hart, who are in similar situation. You know, they grew up with each other. Yeah, because as they often tell us, Eddie and Chavo are uncle and nephew, but actually there's only a couple of years between them. So they're pretty much regarded like brothers. And you think, you know, you think of the great chemistry and the great matches Bret and Owen Hart had, and yet then you think about Jeff and Matt Hardy, who on the occasions that they have wrestled each other, it's always fallen a bit flat. And then you think about the great chemistry between Eddie Guerrero and Rey Mysterio, and how, you know, they always seem to just do, you know, work well together, and they'd always have a good match whenever you put them together.
Well, it's funny, I agree with you completely, but that last example does give you food for thought, because Eddie and Rey had a match at WrestleMania 21, I think, and it was a Mr. Perfect versus Shawn Michaels scenario, where they pretty much said, right, there's this match happening on TV, there's this match happening at the pay-per-view, and it's going to be one of the best matches ever. No pressure, lads. Yeah. And obviously, I think Ray was wearing a hideous mask that he had to keep adjusting, and all that pressure going in. And then they had that series of matches in their feud over the custody of Dominic, which was ridiculous. Yeah. And it did strike me that, yeah, they had great chemistry, and yet if you put too much storyline in it, or you put too much pressure on them, much like Raven and Saturn earlier, it all goes to shit. So it's funny as sometimes you've just got to let wrestlers be wrestlers, and the chemistry comes naturally from there.
Yes.
Do your storylines on TV, hype it up, get the commentators and the interviewers to handle a lot of that and build it up, and then let the wrestlers pay it off with wrestling, and you get the best of both.
Yeah. Once the bell rings, it's just a wrestling match with a storyline around it, I guess.
That's what we are. This is not a proper soap opera or anything. Everything gets paid off in an arena, in a ring, where you're looking to fill seats with tickets. So you have to stick to those principles.
The end of the match sees Chavo get pinned, as I said, with a small package. And then Chavo sort of famously starts shaving his own head with the clippers.
Yes. And that was one of the better, because he's lost the match, and if memory serves me correct, I don't think they did. You know, I think they associated with each other a little bit on TV, maybe. But this is essentially the pay per view blow off to the feud, and he's come out of it stronger, even though he's lost the match, because he's standing there shaving his own head, and Eddie's scared of how psycho he is, and he's come out of it. You know, his character's more entertaining, stronger than it was before, and he's lost the match. So it just shows you the strength of the character. As you can probably tell by the tone of my voice, I was a huge fan of this back in the day, and I still am now, but it really was, you know, the match could and should have been better, but everything else about this was just great wrestling, even if the actual wrestling weren't as great as it could have been.
Yeah, I mean, it is such a memorable image of Chavo laughing his head off while he shaves his own head. And at one point, because he's obviously is rather patchy, his hair does look a bit like the Missing Link, if you remember him at one point in time.
Yes.
So we then move on to Disco Inferno and Conan. Now, Liam, let me ask you a question here. What thoughts and emotions are stirred up in your head if you hear the words "This is a bonus matchup"? Exactly.
The phrase that strikes fear in the hearts of an entire wrestling community.
Yeah. So basically, you're telling people, "I don't worry about this. Go have a piss, have some popcorn, whatever." I have to say, as much as you said about, you know, how much you like Chavo Guerrero, Disco Inferno was one of my guilty pleasures of WCW.
Yeah, he's good, and even around this time, he was pretty good. You know, his chemistry with Alex Wright was always fun.
So Alex Wright cuts a brief promo in German, which this is something I was always taught by Andre Baker, who brought me into wrestling many, many years ago. When we had a guy still wrestling today, George Castano, who's Colombian. And he'd always get him to cut a promo in Spanish just to prove to people that he really was Colombian. It's the same thing here with Alex Wright, who admittedly
You're being polite, Dean. I think you're being very polite. It weren't to prove that they really were, it was to get people to go, "Boo, foreigner, America."
Absolutely. That is also the point of it, but it also just tells people it's not just someone playing a gimmick. They are actually from where they say they are, and to get them to boo them for being dirty, evil foreigners, of course. So Yeah, Conan comes out, NWA Wolfpack music, accompanied by Luger and Kevin Nash. And you kind of touched upon it there about them coming out looking at high school kids, because Nash always just seems to wear the most awful, terrible, inappropriate for his age clothing. You know, he's approaching 40 at this point, and he's kind of wearing what looks like basketball kit.
Yeah. So you've got DX on the other channel, you know, in some ways not much better in certain areas, but they were doing like invading Nitro in Norfolk. They were doing things that made them cutting edge. And on the other side, you've just got the Nashes and the Lugers and the Conans reciting raps and catchphrases and really trying to be as cool, not actually grasping what it was about DX that made them cool in the first place. And it's sad to watch. And the match, thankfully, didn't last long, but that was sad to watch as well. But at least Alex and Disco were funny.
Yes, but I mean, this it goes for about 2 minutes. And it's basically, I'm presuming, a chance to get some of these guys on pay-per-view. I'm trying to think at this time. Obviously, this was the era of guaranteed contracts, but did people get I think they still got bonuses for appearing on pay-per-view at this point in time,
yeah,
didn't they?
I'm sure they did. It was also another time management brain fart. We were talking about how they're all over the place, not sure how to properly segment the pay-per-view, and unadvertised bonus matches reek of that, especially when they're out there for 2 minutes. Meltzer reported that there were plans to have a tag title defense featuring Sting and Luger of the Wolfpack, which didn't happen, which is also incredible because they weren't actually the tag champions at the time. But it was a confusing mess with the tag titles, because you did have, I think at the Great American Bash, you had a singles match where Sting beat the Giant and got both belts. And I think he ended up making Nash his partner, and then it ended up on Rick Steiner and Judy Bagwell, and everyone stopped watching. You know, so I'm sure they would have come up with some sort of plot device to get on Sting and Luger, who always were a good tag team.
Oh yeah, always.
But no, that never happened. We end up getting this, and it's head scratching stuff. It's very, because WCW, and thankfully, as I said before, it didn't last very long. Next.
Yeah, just having a look at this. This was, at this moment in time, yeah, it was Sting and Kevin Nash as the tag champs. Sting won the championships in a singles match at the Great American Bash against the Giant, in which the winner would take control of the tag team championship. And then they lost them a couple of weeks later, July the 20th, to Scott Hall and the Giant. Mm. And then that went to Rick Steiner and Kenny Chaos.
I remember that vaguely.
Who the hell was Kenny Chaos?
Kenny Chaos was, I want to say, High Voltage.
He was
in a tag team called High Voltage, who barely made it off WCW Saturday Night, which at the time was not the show it was in the early 90s.
And yet he was indeed in the tag team of High Voltage.
Yeah.
Yeah, so...
If we don't reach 1,000 episodes, Dean, it's only because we got bored. There's so much.
There is so much content, isn't there?
Oh man.
And now we move on to one of those head scratches you were talking about, Liam. We have the Giant versus Kevin Green. So our first episode covered Starrcade 97, and the Giant was one of the top baby faces for WCW and was feuding with Kevin Nash. 6 months later, he's now a heel, and he's in the NWO, who he'd been feuding with all that time.
Yep.
And I just noted here, switching incessantly between face and heel has basically been the story of Paul White's career.
Oh, yeah. People talk about, oh, you keep turning since you're in WF. You need to watch some WCW, mate. This has been the case since the beginning of...
We've already got Karl Malone and Dennis Rodman in the main event, non-wrestlers, basketball players. And so we now have professional American football player Kevin Green, another non-wrestler. Admittedly, he's had the odd match here or there before. But why on earth would you want another non-wrestler in a match which just dilutes the impact of non-wrestlers being in your main event? I mean, are they thinking that, oh, well, you know, you'll get some basketball fans tuning in to watch Rodman and Malone. Let's get some American football fans tuning in to watch Kevin Green. It just seemed... a very odd time to put this on. And, you know, doesn't it just tell the assembled mainstream press that we've got all around that basically anyone can be a wrestler with the minimum amount of training?
Yeah, that's one of the things I've always disliked about the overuse. You've got to be very careful with using it for that very reason. You need to protect the guys who are full time, otherwise no one's going to show up for anything but these cameos. But my guess, I'm not sure this for certain, but I would, given that the Rodman main event that we'll get to started, there was a big story, you know, there was a long story behind it, but it started initially that they still had a contract that says he'd agreed to work one more wrestling match. So they're first thinking, right, how do we use this? Then the rest came along. We'll discuss that later. I would guess that maybe Kevin Green had something similar, because I think he wrestled in 97, like Rodman did, and maybe he had a contract to burn through. I know that I think the story with the Giant was that they wanted to build him up for Goldberg, which makes sense, except for the fact that they've treated him like shit all the rest of the year, and he lost clean in the main event the previous month. But they want to give him some sort of bounce back. Why not against like a proper wrestler, established wrestler? I don't know, but they've gone with this. But what surprised me most, despite everything working against it and all forms of common sense and anything that you'd associate with wrestling logic working against it, I didn't think this match was that bad. It was an okay match, and Green's nowhere near the worst of the non-wrestlers you'll ever see in a ring. He's okay.
No, he doesn't embarrass himself at all, you know. It's a very basic match. Lots of people are cheering the Giant. Now, is that because he's the wrestler and they're wrestling fans at a wrestling event? Or is that because the NWO are being the cool heels, which plagued wrestling for decades afterwards?
I think it was the former more than the latter. My theory on this is that part of the NWO split is they were aiming to put the heels in one group. They wanted NWO Hollywood to be the dastardly bad guys, and they wanted the cool guys in the Wolfpack, because one thing that was an issue with the main NWO story arc was that far too much these guys who are supposed to be running rampant until they get their comeuppance were getting themselves over, selling merchandise, trying to pander to the crowds, and they wanted all the victories of heels, and they wanted all the adoration and the merchandise sales of a protagonist. So for me, the whole idea of the split was to separate those two entities, and they've established the Giant very much as a heel. This is during his thing where, I don't know if you remember, he'd come out to the ring. I'm not sure if he did it here, but definitely at the Great American Bash and a couple of other times, he'd come out puffing cigarettes in his entrance.
I remember that, yeah.
So he's very much a bad guy. So I think it might have been a revolt to the whole why are you in our ring thing. Who knows? It was a very casual audience at the time, so even that's surprising. So I'm not quite sure.
No, but as you said, it's not that bad a match. And Kevin Green hits a very impressive-looking top rope clothesline as well. And then Giant wins with the choke slam. And what I noticed as well was that he lifts him up high but really protects him on the way down.
Yeah.
Which says a lot to me about Paul White. I mean, I've had very, very minimal interaction with the guy. I interviewed him for a radio show once, but I know a lot of people who have worked around him, and you know, and everyone speaks very highly of him. And yeah, that says a lot about him to me. That he's, yeah, you often get wrestlers who will take liberties with non-wrestlers to kind of show them that, you know, the business is tough, and he's done the opposite. He's been very professional there.
Yeah, I'll join my name to that fan club.
So we then go from the big guys to the cruiserweights, and Chris Jericho, who is feuding at this point with Dean Malenko. And like you said earlier, Liam, Jericho's character at this point is just phenomenal.
Absolute
He's gone
gold.
From being the generic smiling babyface to this incredible heel.
Yeah, WCW Chris Jericho as this heel character. This is what I think of when I think of my early days when I first started reading Power Slam magazine. Any British wrestling fan worth their salt knows exactly what I'm talking about when I say Power Slam magazine. And I started reading in 1998. And I didn't always have access to WCW. It was very spotty, and it come via Bravo and maybe swapping tapes with my schoolmates. But yeah. anything I didn't have enough context of, I'd get duly filled in by, you know, Finn Martin, Rob Butch, all those guys over there. And the first thing I was educated about was how glorious and how entertaining Chris Jericho was. And especially just to read a magazine that weren't saying, boo, bad guy. It was a nice break from the APTA mags, and that's where I started, was reading about Chris Jericho. And then from there, I sought out every part of the timeline, because it pretty much ran through all of 98 and before he refused to sign that contract and got treated like shit until we left.
Yeah, I'm thinking, actually, you've made me think that. I wonder if we can get Finn Martin on this show as a guest one day.
Oh, he'd be more than welcome.
That would be very good. What's encouraging? We're already getting people contacting us wanting to be guests. We are going to bring some guests into these in the near future, I'm sure.
But, definitely.
So we get a video package, a recap of how Malenko basically got himself disqualified from competing at this event. They were told that they couldn't lay a hand on each other, and then Jericho starts talking about Malenko's late father, and they end up, well, Malenko ends up knocking the crap out of Jericho and being told he's not allowed to be a part of the show. I did wonder if they showed a clip of in that brawl of Malenko pulling clumps of Jericho's hair out. And I was wondering if I'm reading too much into it, for that sort of a mock-up of the Bret Hart, Shawn Michaels backstage fight on Raw that was happening previous to that.
Yeah, it was about a year after it, so I'm not sure. Yeah. But maybe, who knows, maybe.
It's maybe with a rib on Bret Hart, who obviously is in WCW at this point.
Yeah. I did love the intensity of the Jericho-Malenko feud. It was always good to watch. Even, I mean, for me, the peak, everyone remember the Battle Royal at Slambury 98.
Oh, when he dresses up as Ciclope.
Yeah. And for me, it was never going to top that.
Yeah.
Clearly, they got some more mileage out of it, but I think it was on the decline from there. And they would drag it out just a little bit more. But what I did like about the whole thing was that the Malenko feud kind of finished by facilitating some other bit part players getting their revenge on Chris Jericho. Case in point, the heel turn started right at the start of 98 on Nitro. He'd have these temper tantrums and he'd snap and he'd rough up Dave Penza. And then he went all the way and he brutalised Rey Mysterio, who's coming out for his next match, and was like, calm down, I've got a match. And he beat the crap out of him. And then they had a match for Rey's title. He won the title. He took it because he needed to have one of his 4 million knee surgeries.
Yes.
And he was off TV from there on. And this whole thing, you know, Malenko can't wrestle. And I loved, I always did love the chemistry between Jericho and JoJo Dillon. And
yes.
their little interactions here, I thought they both played their roles perfectly. And to bring out Ray for his comeuppance for the injury to get the title back was a great touch. It's a shame they did so with such a short and not a very good match, and it's a shame that they just, another Bischoff favourite, they instantly undid the title change on Nitro. But he was the king of loopholes, so.
This match here?
Yeah, so because.
Yes, I was going to say about that, yeah.
Because Malenko was somewhere vaguely near the premises and was suspended, apparently that was enough to disqualify an otherwise clean contest.
Well, yeah, because we'll get to the finish in a moment. But basically, I mean, the great setup for this is that JoJo Dillon, as he calls him, makes out that there's a youngster, an independent guy who hasn't wrestled in 6 months, and Jericho kind of assumes that it's an independent guy he's going to give a chance to, and obviously outcomes Mysterio.
He absolutely Columbo'd him. He played the whole "oh shucks" thing, you know, got him into a full sense of security, then brings out Mysterio, very, very Columbo-esque. And I realise that no one else is going to get that reference.
But it sprung to mind. I love Columbo. I get the reference.
He Columbo'd the Jesus out of him.
And Mysterio even does a hurricane run off the lifeguard tower by the entranceway.
I like that.
And Jericho sells landing in sand as being painful is brilliant. But basically, the end of this is that Dean Malenko walks down the aisle, doesn't do anything more than that. Mysterio reverses an attempt of a lion tamer into a pinfall to win the belt. And even on the replay, you can see that Malenko is way behind the ringside cameraman that's not involved in the match at all. But then, as you say, the title is dusty finish. It's returned to Jericho the next night because of the non-existent interference from Dean Malenko.
Yeah, they'd finally pay it off the next month. They'd have Malenko referee. They'd have Hoovy win the belt, which thankfully segues in what we were talking about during match two. You know, the Hoovies and the Kidmans getting their chance with the belt. Jericho was definitely ready for things like the TV title. Unfortunately, didn't go much more in that. But we got Y2J, so it was even better. And Malenko was ready to move on. As you'd see with the post-match kerfuffle, Jericho and Malenko were brought backstage, and Arn Anderson would help Malenko get some shots in on Jericho, because then we move Malenko on to the Horseman.
Of course, yes. So the Benoit and Malenko era of the Horseman, yes.
There are quite a few islands of good storytelling and good logic swimming in this sea of shit that is 1998 WCW.
So next we have, we're sticking all our title matches at the end, pretty much. We have Bret Hart and Booker T for the WCW World title. And Bret Hart comes out to the NWO theme tune. And at first I'm thinking, hang on a minute, was he ever in the NWO? And I read up about it to remind myself. He was an associate of the NWO, but he'd helped Hogan regain the world title from Randy Savage. And Savage, who'd since turned face again since Starrcade and had held the belt for one whole day, if you're keeping up. It baffled me as to why you've got someone who's such a valuable commodity as Bret Hart, you know, the face of WWE at the time, or, you know, the year before, and you've now turned him heel. It was just odd to me.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much everything you've touched upon in that one passage sums up what WCW did to go from the hottest company around to dead within a couple more years. As Alvarez and Reynolds put in their fantastic, I'll say again, their fantastic book, Death of WCW, you know, they're pulling great numbers in 1998, but the decline doesn't fall in line with those things, because people will watch for a little bit, and if they watch a few straight months of crap, then they'll start tuning out, and that's why the numbers just started dropping in 1999. Some of everything you just described there only makes sense to me because I watched it unfold. I've rewatched a lot of 98 WCW recently, and even then I have to just double check and go, right, that's all right, isn't it? Okay. To someone who's walking in like a casual wrestling fan or someone who never watched WCW, they'd be like, what the fuck? And rightfully so. And this is where they lost a lot of that diehard fan base. And this, I think this is more of a talking point than the match, because I have no idea why they paired the two up. They should be a good pairing. And there's some little glimmers of great chemistry there. But again, it's another relatively brief match that goes nowhere in a feud that I'm not quite sure why they did at that specific time between Book and Bret Hart. And ends with a hint that Harlem Heat are going to split up, when we all thought they'd already split up, because Booker T's great and Stevie Ray isn't, and we'd prefer him to just stick to 10-second handshake matches.
I mean, Booker T comes over the top rope with a dive to the outside. Bret Hart hits him with a chair, and it's a DQ, and we've basically got a Nitro finish on a pay-per-view.
Yeah. This was another thing. There were so many Nitro-esque matches. We're only months away from a Starrcade that had Norman Smiley versus Prince Iaukea or something like that on Starrcade. And they do this a lot, whether it's pointless matches between no names to fill time or nonsensical things between two genuine talents and big names. It's just the time management and the planning. It was non-existent, Dean. It was absolutely non-existent. I keep coming back to it, but I feel like I have to. It was terrible.
And then, as you say, we get this weird thing between Steve Ray and Booker T that goes nowhere. Gets out the ring, helps him, doesn't help him. Yeah. Odd.
He would turn heel and join NWO Hollywood, and no one cared. He never actually... Well, he did feud with Booker T a lot, you know, later on, we're talking early 2000 here, we'll get to that. But for the time, they're hinting at like a proper split up, maybe a feud over the TV title, but it never actually happened. It was just very random and very apathetic.
So we then get it's time for the Goldberg match. So we have a recap of him beating Hogan for the world title at the Georgia Dome.
Yep.
And so this match, Goldberg and Kurt Hennig, it had been signed before Goldberg won the belt. Now, the fact that that's happened and now been made a world title, it either shows that they've made it look totally legit by just keeping the match but adding the title belt, or probably more likely that they weren't thinking about putting the belt on Goldberg at the time that they signed, that they put this match together and announced it. I'm not quite sure which is which.
Got it in one, Dean. I think there weren't much pre-thought between. I think they went back and forth between the idea a lot. In this instance, they've got a match already set, and to be fair, you know, you've got a guy who's just got the world title. He's hot and he's got all the potential in the world, but he's still quite inexperienced. His match is due to be against Kurt Hennig. On paper, why would you change that? If you think of guys who are famous kingmakers in wrestling, the guys who you stick with your stars early on to help establish them, and Mick Foley's won the best of all time at that, and another guy is Kurt Hennig. He's a guy you put in the ring with one of your stars to make sure they hit the ground running. The problem was, is at the time, I don't know if you noticed this, but he did not look anywhere near his peak condition. He looked a bit all over the shop, and thankfully for Kurt, it was a short match, a typical Goldberg match, because if he tried to work a proper 15-20 minute match in that condition, I think it would have sullied his reputation a little bit.
I can't say I noticed that myself. I'll have to have a look at it again. But
he didn't look great.
I mean, the thing I also thought was, yeah, did anyone ever think that Kurt Hennig had a chance of becoming the world champion against Goldberg? It really was, but then it was a brief match. You know, it was a foregone conclusion.
Yeah.
Goldberg makes a real pig's ear of sort of a rolling takedown, and Hennig's working the ankle and the knee, but Goldberg, who's never been great at selling, doesn't really do that good a job of selling. It's tricky, I suppose, because, you know, he's meant to be portrayed as this indestructible guy, but at the same time, you need to sell a bit to kind of give the match a bit of length. And he's not really used to that at this point in his career. Goldberg kicks out of the, as they call it here, the Hennigplex, hits the spear, hits the jackhammer, wins in under 4 minutes. The only other thing I noted here was, and this is just the benefit of hindsight, knowing what we know now, it does make me cringe about Goldberg's pre-match locker headbutting routine. Can't be good for you.
But then this is the man who walks through actual fireworks being aimed at him.
Yes, and breathes the fumes out.
Which was, you know, it's awe-inspiring stuff. But like quite a few things from this era, it's a silly price to pay. And thankfully, we've gone full circle in the industry and we're going back to making less mean more. And you can still get a great reaction by not trying to maim yourself.
Yes. So it's time to build up the main event. And we have this kind of, I say silent, as in there's no sound, there's no commentary, there's just music. It's sort of a series of video clips with music over the top. And I guess take yourself back to 1998, it does come across to me like something you'd get as a cutaway scene in a Mega Drive or N64 game.
Either that, I don't know if it was a WWE Network thing, a dub over, because that does happen as well. I'm not quite sure, to be honest.
Possibly.
If possible, you might be right, but those things happen sometimes.
Jericho has his WWE music dubbed over in all of these, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And Hogan in this comes out to the NWO theme, but I'm thinking at this time, wasn't he coming out to Voodoo Child?
Almost definitely, yeah.
But obviously, legend had it, he paid $100,000 for the rights to use that. But obviously, that was WCW, and this is the WWE Network. But
they're willing to do it sometimes. But obviously, on the network, there's bigger potential payouts, isn't there?
Implications, yeah. So our main event is Diamond Dallas Page and Karl Malone of Utah Jazz against Hollywood Hogan and Dennis Rodman of Chicago Bulls, arguably the most famous basketball player in the world at that time.
Mostly not for playing basketball.
Yes. And I mean, this was, it's got to be said, this was a huge coup for WCW to get these. I mean, I was trying to think, you know, would it be the equivalent in this country of getting some Premier League footballers to wrestle one another?
Maybe. Well, the coup is probably with Malone. Rodman, as we touched upon, had a match left on his contract. And believe it or not, at one point earlier in 1998, WCW were giving serious consideration to blowing through that remaining commitment by having him appear at a Tokyo Dome show for New Japan, who they're affiliated with at this time. Can you imagine that? Dennis Rodman at the Dome.
Wrestling.
Where Dave Meltzer probably would have felt obliged to give it 4.5 stars just because it's at the Dome. I kid. I know Meltzer struggles and really deadpans the jokes, but I'm a huge fan of that meme. It's all light jest and it's one of my favourites. Gotta love Meltzer. But yeah, it's from him that I sourced this. It's from an old Wrestling Observer newsletter. They were going to burn through it, having wrestled at the Dome, and New Japan rightly thought, well, what have we got to gain out of this? And so it never happened.
Yeah.
So, looking for a way to use them again, suddenly they had the... I'm not sure, because I'm not sure... I like NBA, but I'm not an encyclopedia. But Malone and Rodman, I believe, had a bit of a dust-up during the basketball season.
Yes, that's why they mentioned this in the commentary, yeah.
And that's where the opportunity came to them, and they managed to convince Malone to make a bit of a play of it, and it was, you know, mainstream wise, it did great. But in the ring, that's where it all fell apart.
Well, it went on for 25 minutes almost, yeah. Hogan's got his old mate Brutus Beefcake, known as the Disciple, in on the action, getting him a pay per view bonus by getting them to accompany them to ringside. Although, to be fair, you know, you want an experienced pro to be around in case Rodman got lost or anything.
Not that it helped in the end.
No, that was the theory. But, yeah, this is the match that DDP himself credits as truly launching him into superstardom, isn't it?
Well, that's funny, because watching the match, all he can do at the time is swear under his breath. And do you know what? He actually came over to the UK a couple of weeks ago, and I'm a DDP yoga user. I've had some neck issues, and I'm really grateful for what it's done. And it was an honour to go to the yoga workshop, meet the man. I did some publicity work for them and got some articles up on Yahoo as well. And he did a Q&A, like everyone who comes over as him, who doesn't have their own yoga business, generally just comes over for the Q&A. And he touched upon just how miserable and angry was during this match. And yeah, it was a big moment for him. And that might have tied into it. He's probably fearing that if this continues to fall apart the way it was threatening to early on, that his big moment was going to end up being a nightmare. And the only one having a nightmare really was Dennis Rodman when he had a little catnap on the turnbuckle.
So you touched this earlier. He basically was out on the lash the night before.
Yeah, so he was at a Pearl Jam concert. He did complete bender, all-nighter, and no one was surprised, because this is the man who missed training for the playoffs, which is like a footballer over here getting smashed the week of the FA Cup final, the Champions League final, and missing training, where they're strategizing to try and beat Real Madrid and win the Champions League, and one of the star players decides to just go get hammered and not show up for training. And of course, if he's going to do that ahead of the most important aspect of what really makes his money and his name, of course he's going to do it before a 25-minute fake wrestling match. Of course. So, again, why did this happen? Because WCW. They've got no one to blame but themselves.
Oh, man. You know what you're getting yourself into with Dennis Rodman. You know, I work as many people would probably know, I've worked for a long time in British wrestling as a commentator. You know, I often talk with the guys running the promotions, and you know, often we're thinking about, you know, what American talent, what overseas talent is available to bring over, and you'll start reeling off names. And there are certain people, I'm not going to name names for the sake of professionalism, but there are certain people that, you know, you'll name them and everyone just looks and immediately goes, no way, we're not touching that guy with a barge pole because of his reputation.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you do bring in a guy with a reputation like that and then they live up to that reputation, you really haven't got anyone to blame but yourself.
I can see why they were going to send him to Tokyo, I'll say that much.
But, yeah.
You know, the short term, they did good business with this. It, you know, it got a lot of eyes on them. The problem is, as we touched on earlier, is the eyes are being trained on what is fast becoming a massive sack of shit. Same with the hotshot of Goldberg Hogan. They're popping big ratings, buy rates, getting lots of publicity. And there's no reason for people to stick around because it's the same guy it was 2 years ago. It's the same shit it was 2 years ago. And as we would find out as we move along the timeline, none of this changes. Rodman even got another pay-per-view match the following year, which I won't drag on too much about it on this one, but I actually found that match with Randy Savage perversely entertaining.
I don't even remember that.
Oh, well, that show will be covered in due time. Don't you worry about that.
Yeah. So, there's another thing I just didn't understand. Now, I think we mentioned this in the first podcast that, you know, I've been a wrestling manager at times and I've done angles where, you know, I've involved myself in a match where it's been like a 2-on-3 or a 1-on-2 handicap match with me as the extra person on the heel side.
Yeah.
And, you know, the novelty of the match, the point of interest of the match is that you as a non-wrestler are wrestling and you therefore try and drag it out for as long as you can. You know, you make it mean something when you finally come in the ring. And here we start the match with Rodman and Malone, which just baffled me because surely you'd want to start with Hogan and DDP and then gradually, slowly introduce the wrestlers in, maybe have Rodman playing a bit of a chicken shit heel, getting a few digs in and tagging out again. But instead, we start with the points of interest, the curiosities. And you've also got Rodman wrestling with all his piercings in, which is a bit of has health and safety written all over it for me. It was, again, I've said it before in this, and I'll say it again, very odd.
Yeah, I mean, who needs suspense, Dean, when you've got stupidity? That seems to be the theme of this. It's baffling because, you know, if you're going to run with this whole thing, you can... You can make a gimmick of bringing them in, building the suspense, having them come in. But in the end, I think like Rodman's in for the first 5 minutes of the match and does nothing for those 5 minutes.
Lots of stalling, yeah.
You can just hire Larry Zbysko for that for half the price.
Yeah, but this does, you know, on a positive note, because I don't just want to be negative about things if we can avoid it. This has got much more of a big fight feel than Hogan Sting at Starrcade 97 ever did.
Unfortunately, yeah. And yeah, I agree. We do try not to be completely negative, but this show and this main event really do put that to the test. But I'll throw another positive out there for you. Malone looked pretty good. You know, he's a great size. He looked, unlike Rodman, he looked up for the challenge he'd signed on for. You know, he delivered a couple of moves and looked all right. Again, like a bit of very Kevin Green-esque, as he didn't do much, but what he did do, it looked acceptable.
Yeah, the wrestlers made, you know, you did have the wrestlers in there with the basketball players a lot of the time, and, you know, to their credit, the wrestlers made the basketball players' offense look great until they start getting tired and it gets all clumsy and breaks down.
And, I think Paige has got a great work rate, but there are wrestlers out there, even in the company, who've got much more of a technical use of handling things like this. So he's not really the guy to take the lead in a four-man circus. Hogan has proven that he's a one-trick pony as far as the sort of match he can take the lead on, and he's in no fit state, especially at this stage of his career, to carry it. And you've got two guys who need carrying, so it's the blind leading the blind.
And there's one horrible moment where I don't know what they're trying to do, but basically Rodman collides with DDP. DDP sort of falls into a sitting position on the floor by the ropes. Rodman falls face first. That is one of those moments where DDP, you can see, is cursing under his breath and the crowd just start booing.
Yeah. And then we've got the finish, which is... you got a finish that comes, by the way, Brutus the Barber Beefcake delivering a stunner.
Yeah. I mean, what I will say as well as a positive is that the commentators, yeah, we've criticised the commentators before, but they in this match, I thought they did a great job of papering over the cracks as best as they could.
Well, yeah, this is what Tony Schiavone was doing. You touched upon saying at the start of this podcast, just trying to remember where it was. I think it was the logic of Raven's rules and who it applies to. And yeah, Schiavone couldn't really do much with that, and he might have drawn more attention to something. But again, I found that to be consistent, and I always found that to be one of the things I appreciated about Tony, is that he really would try to make sense. And to me, the times where he tried and failed miserably to make sense, I can really attribute to just what was being thrust upon his lap. And this is another great example of that.
I mean, he's talking a lot about the physical demands of wrestling compared to basketball and how fit basketball players have to be. And, you know, he does a good job there. And also the other thing I thought was that Hogan and DDP came out, you know, or DDP came out looking on a relatively equal footing to Hogan, you know, which is, as we said, this where, you know, this really elevates DDP into the main event, the superstardom. But, the finish is very... very odd. The disciple, as he's called, hits DDP with a diamond cutter with his own move behind the referee's back.
Sorry, the apocalypse, apparently.
The apocalypse.
Yeah, his stunner was the apocalypse.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, that had escaped my memory. But the heel team win for a completely flat finish, and then the only kind of... thing that happens after that is that Charles Robinson takes a diamond cutter from Malone for basically doing his job and counting the pinfall.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's again, surely in these situations, ordinarily, the baby faces go over. You know, you look at Lawrence Taylor and Bam Bam Bigelow, you look at Floyd Mayweather and The Big Show, and it's the baby face non-wrestler who goes over. And I guess we have got the non-wrestler on each side, but we've got one definite babyface and one heel. And Starrcade 97 was kind of ruined. The finish that was ruined by Hulk Hogan dictating to Nick Patrick not to do a fast count. You'd have to think, seeing as he had creative control in his contract, that this was Hogan wanting to win the match and go off at the end of the match with his arms held aloft with Dennis Rodman beside him.
Yeah, I mean, come on, man. It's as you touched upon, it's not even like Hogan had to eat a pinfall to lose. You've got Rodman right there. I don't know if Rodman's able to protect himself from having to lose one of these contracting matches. And if that's the case, that may be one of the most because WCW things that we could possibly cover. But I did mention earlier in the thing that there was another... You know, my ongoing consistent rant in this podcast about this pay-per-view has been, like most Bischoff pay-per-views, the time management has been asinine. And here's the big payoff for that. So Hogan wanted 45 minutes. Things were danced around because of Hogan's edict. Back and forth, bonus matches being cut short, interviews with Eddie Guerrero being thrown out there, they're all over the shop. And the payoff is... they've got 10 minutes of pay-per-view time to fill after the match has finished. So you've got the NWO celebrating. Again, as you touched upon, like their baby faces, they're not. And then we've got the commentators just wrapping up the show because they've got spare time. Because they're a fucking joke.
Oh man.
That migraine has well and truly set in. I did predict. I predicted one for this show. And yeah. Shall we finish on a positive, Dean?
Let's.
So I want to talk about this because this was, you know, as we're coming up with the idea of discussing WCW and all the peaks and troughs, we're thinking of little side things to have some fun, because, you know, there's always a lot of fun in remembering WCW for better or worse. And one of the things we love personally, myself and Dean, are the entrance themes, even though most of them are, you know, rip-offs made by Jimmy Hart. They do. Wrestling themes have this way of sitting in your memory. Wrestling fans do love a wrestling theme every bit as much as we love a chart album, sad as it is, I know. And so what we're going to do, and we'll start off with your hand-picked choice, Mr. AS, is I suppose we'll alternate every episode and finish off by picking a classic WCW theme and having a little chat and a little reminisce about it. So your pick, I'll rev it up now, and hopefully a few people remember this one.
Okay, well, yeah, we're going all the way back to 1989 when this started out. Two big masked guys who then lost their masks, Ron Simmons and Butch Reed, the team of Doom. So, I mean, I loved this tune, but it didn't really fit, did it? Is it just me, or did it just, it was kind of this funky kind of music for two big, bad, kick-ass heels who just needed some kind of chug-chug, I'm going to kick your ass type music?
Yeah, yes and no is my answer, because I have some very spotty memories of the early 90s WCW. I started properly getting into the week-by-week, so WCW, call it late 91, early 92. It'll come by the way of ITV would have an hour of WCW on Saturday afternoons, and I think they also had it late at night, but, you know, come on, I was eight. So for me, it was Saturday afternoons.
Different regions of the country, because ITV had different regional broadcasts.
Yeah.
And I think it started in about 91, thinking about how things panned out. I think it was about 91 time, 92 time. And it was on something stupid like 3 o'clock in the morning, Saturday night, Sunday morning.
Yeah.
And I used to stay up and watch it at like 3 a.m. It would be after great programs like Get Stuffed and Shaka Zulu, marvelous times. But and then I think, yeah, then I remember the graphics changing to a different color scheme, like a purple and yellow color scheme, and it became WCW Worldwide was then aired on a Saturday afternoon, as you say.
Yeah, and that's where I jumped in. It'll be, ironically, considering what we're discussing today, it'll be WCW followed by NBA Jam or something like that, like a magazine recapping the week's basketball and giving you that basketball day. I had happy memories though, Saturday afternoons. It was great. But yeah, so I jumped in then. Anything else before that, my point is, would have been very, very retrospect and all over the place. Like, I happened upon Halloween Havoc 1990 when a friend brought in videotape at school. And Doom were on that. I think Doom were in one profile matches defending the tag titles against two of the Horsemen. So it might have been Flair and Anderson, or Flair and Windham. Or, yeah, I think it's Flair and Anderson. That was a good match. And this was, you know, they'd lost the masks because they came in masked with Woman. They lost the masks. They lost Woman. They became managed by Teddy Long. And that's what I remember by this theme, is it's very much Teddy Long's client's theme than it is so much Doom. But I love it. It's such a generically groovy tune that it shows that even though everyone talks about the New World Order coming out to porno music, it shows that Doom had that licked like 6 years before that.
They were coming out to porno music, yeah, before the NWO was even invented.
Yeah,
I like to think that, you know, each time that music played, that either Ron Simmons or Butch Reed absolutely fucking hated it. Because you think about it, if you're a wrestler and you've got music that you hate and you have to listen to it for your entrance every single time you come out to wrestle, must be a killer.
It's worth remembering that back in this time frame in the early 90s, there wasn't a great scope of range or personality in entrance themes. A lot of them, you'd have to be a sad diehard fan like the two of us and many of our listeners to be able to spot the exact difference between Lex Luger's heel theme in 1991 and Marcus Alexander Bagwell's theme. You know what I mean? So a lot of them, I'd imagine, were just music that come out. You know, music had been popularized a few years before. Everyone's a big edict. Everyone's got to have entrance music. Here's a riff. Here's a riff. You get a riff. You get a riff. Everyone gets a riff, Oprah style. So I'd be shocked if they gave much of a shit, to be honest. But in retrospect, it's one of those ones that stands out a lot more than it probably did back then. It's a shame because when I think of Doom and entrance music, I think of another one. I don't think it would qualify for this segment because it's an actual song. You'll remember, Dean, when the NWA were in full pomp in the 80s, they would actually use licensed songs. Like you have Iron Man for the Road Warriors, etc., etc. And when they made, I'm a huge fan of Doom's debut because you had the storyline where a woman led Rick Steiner astray and then turned on Rick. He brought his brother in.
And she was a ringside fan called Robin Green to start with.
Yeah, and she wanted revenge on Rick and his brother who was like watching out for him. So she went and hired these two big imposing thugs. And I remember, again, the music will be defined by the manager and they come out to her strut, which was terrific. I remember she came out, she looked absolutely incredible. That entrance, you could hear the fans all whistling how good she looked. They came out, you know, 6 foot tall, physical peaks, oiled up, big masks on, black dress. They just looked like extremely scary thugs who were hired by her to basically break their opponent's neck. The Steiner was like, we got to like fight for our lives here. And that's what unfolded. And that was a start of Doom. That's what I always remember about Doom. But yeah, that, under Teddy Long, they had some good moments. And this theme song was one of them.
Yeah, and also on TV at that time, and this is a whole nother subject for a whole nother day, Doom had some of the most entertainingly brutal squash matches of all time.
Yes, it really played up to what they were, and that was just a pair of bruisers.
Especially if one of the jobbers didn't quite take a move properly and made it look bad. They would then get a receipt from Ron Simmons.
And that happened a lot. That scarily happened a lot on WCW Worldwide on Saturday night. Especially in skyscrapers matches where someone will decide, right, I'm not going to sell Sid Vicious's powerbomb.
What's the worst? Man, you've seen that one. Yeah.
What's the worst that can possibly happen? I'll just like be unprofessional against it. And then Dan Spivey just kicked the ever-loving shit out of him.
And he was never seen again.
Shock, yeah. What's the worst that can happen?
Oh, man. Right, I think that brings us to the end of episode 2. Thanks for joining us. Congratulations if you're still with us. Thank you very much for listening. If you have enjoyed this, we would love to hear from you. You can follow us and message us on Twitter at BecauseWCW, or you can find us. We've got a Facebook page. Again, look for BecauseWCW. If you have enjoyed this, please, please, please tell friends, tell two friends. We want to keep growing this. Hopefully the sound is better than it was in week one. But hey, we're learning this as we go. We're learning on the job, Liam.
Now, I like to stick to we're paying tribute to WCW production value.
This is true.
But yeah, we are looking. You know, we are novices on the technological side, and we're gonna work on this. So bear with us, and hopefully each episode will just get a little bit more polished. Fingers crossed.
And yeah, we haven't even covered how you got credits at the end of WCW pay-per-views. That's another story for another day. Anyway, on behalf of my co-host, the ever-knowledgeable Liam Hatt, this is the Twisted Genius Dean Ayres. Thanks for joining us at Because WCW. I'll see you ringside.